All right, so we are very happy to have Jim Prop talking about the tilings again. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, thank you, Emily. Thank you, Amanda, for organizing this seminar and for coming up with the idea in the first place and for inviting me to speak here. So, my talk is entitled Tilings Again, and the slides are already up on the web. So, if you want to follow or look back at any earlier slides, you can certainly do that in parallel with watching me. So, I now have this. There we go. Okay. So, for anyone like Doron and perhaps others who are not at UMass Lowell and don't know about working on Watt, it's meant to be an informal seminar, so please interrupt with questions. Any questions? Okay.
Can you go back to show the link again?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. But please also mute yourself if you don't have questions, since I've turned noise suppression off, which may mean we pick up background noise that you don't intend to share. So, I'm going to start with the last 50 years and then sort of zoom in on the present. So, this takes us back to probably around 1974, maybe 1975. I was a big fan of Martin Gardner's Scientific Americans column, Scientific American columns. And here's one that appeared around then called The Mutilated Chessboard. The props, huh? I wonder if he had some prophetic ability to see that I was going to find this interesting. The props for this problem are a chessboard and 32 dominoes. Each domino is of such size that it exactly covers two adjacent squares on the board. The 32 dominoes, therefore, can cover all 64 of the chessboard squares. But now suppose we cut off two squares at diagonally opposite corners of the board. See figure 13 and discard one of the dominoes. Is it possible to place the 31 dominoes on the board so that all the remaining 62 squares are covered? If so, show it how it can be done. If not, prove it impossible. And I'm going to spoil this for those of you who haven't seen it before. It is impossible to cover the mutilated chessboard with two opposite corner squares cut off with 31 dominoes, and the proof is easy. The two diagonally opposite corners are of the same color. Therefore, their removal leaves a board with two more squares of one color than of the other. Each domino covers two squares of opposite color, since only opposite colors are adjacent. After you have covered 60 squares with 30 dominoes, you are left with two uncovered squares of the same color. These two cannot be adjacent, therefore, they cannot be covered by the last domino. So back then, that just seemed like a curiosity, but turns out that there's a sort of more fancy version of this idea that is still being explored, which I learned about from Jeff Ligarius in a talk he gave at the Asilomar Conference Center either in 1985 or 1987. There's John Conway, there's Jeff Ligarius. Here's the paper they published a few years later called Tiling with Polyominoes and Combinatorial Group Theory. Wonderful paper. The kind of region they were interested in tiling was a triangular region made of hexagonal cells. So here's the one with five on a side. They called it T sub five. It has area 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So you could hope to tile it with five tiles, each of which has three hexagons in it. Here are the sort of tiles they proposed using. At the lower left, you can see a triangular tile called a T2, which has area 3. And at the right, you see a three in a line tile, which they called L3 for linear. And they showed that the triangular region T sub n in the hexagonal lattice can be tiled by congruent copies of the triangular tile T2, if and only if n is congruent to 0, 2, 9, or 11 mod 12. So in particular, T5 cannot be tiled. And also, no T sub n can be tiled if you just use copies of the three in a line tile L3. So I should be clear that you're allowed to rotate these tiles so the triangular tile has two different orientations, pointing up and pointing down, and the three in a line tile has three different orientations. The way they proved this was using a new technique coming from combinatorial group theory. And I'm not going to have time to talk about that, but one of the comments they make is that you could go back and apply the same technique to domino tilings. So I'm not going to explain what the combinatorial group theory is here. though I will sort of foreshadow Thurston's take on this. Thurston's take is that as you travel around the boundary of a tileable region, you should see as many shaded as unshaded squares on your left as you complete the route, and if you don't, that region cannot be tiled with dominoes. So I will come back to that in a minute. I'm going to talk now about Thurston's paper. It came out in the same year, but the preprint was a response to the preprint of Conway and Ligarius's, and he phrased things in more topological language and also in more geometric language. And this is the article I actually drew a lot of inspiration from. And Thurston showed it didn't just apply to dominoes, it also applied to other sorts of regions in such a nice way. So here's an example of a region tiled by lozenges. And a lozenge is a union of two equilateral triangles, one pointing up and one pointing down. And Thurston showed that there's a really nice way you can take that picture in the plane and lift it up into three dimensions. And I want to point out that your eye is probably already doing that. If you look at this thing, it probably suggests a third dimension to you. So your eye is already inferring some of what Thurston is writing about. So let me express it in terms of something that a computer could do, not just a human brain. So here's an assignment of numbers to the vertices in this tiling. And here I've shaded the up pointing triangles and left the down pointing triangles unshaded. And the rule is that as I travel around through the tiling, traveling only along tile edges, never along the interior of a tile, the number goes up by one if you've got a shaded triangle to your left, and it goes down by one if you've got an unshaded triangle to your left, or equivalently, a white triangle. Sorry, an unshaded triangle to your left, or equivalently, a shaded triangle to your right. And we call that a height function, and it corresponds in Thurston's picture to the distance between this surface that the eye infers and the reference plane down below. So, for instance, you can see over here, there's some high points over here. And over here, you can see that the number 5 is the highest number that occurs. So that's sort of the distance from some background towards your eye as you look at this thing and infer a third dimension. So tilings determine height functions and vice versa. So here's how you go in one direction. If you've got a tiling, then assign some height to an arbitrary point. You can choose any point you like to serve as a reference point. And now start visiting all the vertices of the tiling, traveling along tile edges. So notice in this picture, every vertex lies along a tile edge, and you can reach any vertex from any other by traveling along edges of tiles. So as you go, we're going to assign heights, and we have no freedom. When you travel along a tile edge, the height goes up by one when there's a shaded triangle on your left, and the height goes down by one if there's a shaded triangle on your right. So there's a unique way to do this, up to a constant. So we need to think about this for a second. How do we know we don't get into a contradiction when we travel along a long itinerary and come back to where we started? Well, it's enough to show that when you travel along a single tile going, say, counterclockwise, you don't hit a contradiction because of the way you could sort of add regions topologically. So that if going around a single tile causes you to come back to the same height you started, then going around multiple tiles, it'll still be true. And for a single tile, just notice that as you travel around the boundary, there's a shaded triangle to your left twice, and an unshaded triangle to your left twice. So you go up by two in height and down by two in height. And so you end up back at that you started with. So this thing is globally consistent, and it's also forced by your initial joint of an assignment of height to a specified vertex. So that's why I say there's a unique way to do this up to a constant. Any questions about that so far? And in the other direction, if you've got a height function and you want to know what the tiling is, where the height changes by plus or minus one, draw a tile edge. Otherwise, don't draw a tile edge. So it's not hard to show that that reconstructs a lozenge tiling of the region for you, assuming one exists. So Thurston did the same thing for dominoes, and this is equivalent to the thing that Conway and Ligarius did that I showed you a few slides back, but I find it more intuitive. So here is a domino tiling in the plane. Actually, he doesn't show the domino tiling here. He just shows the lifted surface.
Jim.
Jim, can I? I'm sorry. Can I interrupt?
Absolutely.
So you've convinced me that any lozenge tiling lifts into three dimensions, but I wasn't sure. I'm not sure I connected the dots on why that was so important. So what does lifting into three dimensions do for you?
It gives you a richer way to understand tilings. So, for example, if you wanted to know how to mutate one tiling into another, you might think like, well, I don't know how to do that. I'll just mess around. But in fact, you can give an exact formula for the number of moves required to morph one tiling into another by way of certain kinds of moves I'm going to describe shortly. And
Okay.
the way you compute that is with the height functions.
Okay. All right. So to be seen. All right.
To
Thank
be
you.
seen.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
So here's how a height function looks for a domino tiling. And the game is kind of the same. So your eye does not do this. So your eye does not infer three dimensions of a three-dimensional surface from a picture like this. But the same math that we used in defining these kinds of height functions also works for domino tilings. And in fact, this is the exact same slide that I showed you before, word for word. So if you've got a domino tiling and you want to determine its height function, impute a height to a specific vertex and then travel around the tiling. You can visit every vertex in the tiling by traveling along tile edges. And the rule is when you travel along a tile edge, the height should go up by one when there's a shaded triangle on your left and down by one if there's a shaded triangle on your right. And once again, there's a unique way to do this. And that's because as you travel around any tile, you're going to have a shaded triangle to your left three times and an unshaded triangle, sorry, square. You'll have a shaded square to your left three times, an unshaded square to your left three times. So the height will go up by three, down by three, and it'll be consistent when you come back to the vertex you started with. So we have local consistency going around any tile, and this implies global consistency as you travel along any path using just edges of tiles. So that's the proof that such a thing exists, and it's really forced to be unique up to your choice of an original height for a specified vertex by the fact that this rule gives you no freedom for assigning heights of any vertices. And to go in the reverse direction, if you've got a height function where the height changes by plus or minus one, draw a tile edge. Where the height changes by anything else, don't draw a tile edge. So we get a sort of more enriched and informative combinatorial structure associated with the tiling that lets us figure some things out that we otherwise would not have been able to. One thing it gives is a linear time algorithm for tileability. So a priori, every finite tileability problem, namely, can this region be tiled or not, can be solved in time exponential in the area of the region being tiled. And in some generic sense, some results in computational complexity tell us that you should expect it to be, exponential. This is kind of verging on, there are some NP complete problems you can cook up in the form of tiling problems. But in the case of dominoes and lozenges, you can actually use height functions to provide a linear time algorithm for lozenges and dominoes. And the height function plays an essential role in Thurston's algorithm. So that's one thing that height functions buy you. And we'll see other things that height functions buy you. Any questions so far? Okay, so I'm a combinatorialist. More specifically, I'm an enumerative combinatorialist. So I love to count things. So what can I count? Well, McMahon counted tilings long before I was born, although he didn't think of them as tilings. This is a rephrasing of his theorem. The number of lozenge tilings of a regular hexagon of side length n is the product, as I, j, and k go from 1 to n, of I plus j plus k minus 1 over I plus j plus k minus 2. So he thought of this as a result about plane partitions, but you can also view it as a result about tilings. So I thought there's got to be something analogous to this for domino tilings, once I'd seen the whole analogy that Thurston laid out between lozenge tilings and domino tilings. And after playing around for a bit, I came up with a conjecture that Elkies, Cooperberg, Larson, and I proved in a bunch of different ways. This is a theorem we proved in 1988, which is the number of tilings of this kind of region is always a power of two. So this is called the Aztec diamond. It consists of a row of length 2, followed by a row of length 4, followed by a row of length 6, and so forth, up to a row of length 2n, all centered. And then another row of length 2n, and then rows of decreasing length, decreasing down to length 2. And the number of domino tilings of this shape is 2 to the power of n times n plus 1 over 2. So I should say I'm really glad that Doron is here, because Doron, one of your papers inspired me, because you had a theorem about directed animals, and you showed that the number of such things was a power of 3. And so you thought to yourself, well, I know how to generate some combinatorial objects uniformly where the number is a power of 3, namely strings of digits chosen from the set 0, 1, 2. So if I had a bijection between those things, which are easy to generate randomly, and these directed animals, I would be able to look at what a random directed animal looks like. And even if I couldn't prove things, I could, draw pretty pictures and come up with some conjectures. So I want to do the same thing with domino
Well, it's a
tilings.
beautiful result, very elegant, so exquisite and simple.
Yeah. So sometimes we want a bijection just because we like bijection, but sometimes there's a real reason to look for a bijective proof of an enumerative formula. By the way, I was not the first person to conjecture this formula. Some physicists 10 years before, in the context of the Dimer model on a square grid, looked at this. So that's equivalent to this. I just want to say, if you take a dot, put a dot in the middle of each square in the underlying square grid and join the dots by a bond when they share a tile, you get this kind of a picture. So this is a perfect matching of a certain graph. It's the a weak dual graph of this region. And so this kind of thing had been studied under the name the Dimer model on a square grid. Physicists were very interested in it, but Gregson, Karlsson, and Zapp thought that this was kind of a disappointing thing to look at, because they noticed the formula and they stated it, but they didn't give proof. I think one reason they didn't give a proof is physicists often don't think they need to prove all their conjectures, only the important ones. And the other things, you just notice that they're true, and if anyone really wanted to, they could prove it. But why waste time proving things when you can go on to the next beautiful conjecture? So it's a different approach to doing things at the border between math and physics. But they noticed that this formula did not agree with the asymptotic entropy of tilings of the square grid. So from their point of view, it just wasn't that interesting. And this reinforces a point that I believe Freeman Dyson stated. I tried to source this quote. There's often mathematical gold in the trash cans of physicists. Mandelbrot did say something similar, but I'm still convinced that Dyson said it somewhere. I just haven't been able to find the quote. So I did not find this conjecture by rummaging through the trash cans of physicists. I just rediscovered it. But I think there's a lot of wisdom there. Anyway, once I saw there was a power, yeah?
Another question. Why the diamond shape? There's lots of things you could, I guess, count tilings of. But how did this come up?
Yeah, this came up by thinking about actually a result for the number of domino tilings of a 2n by 2n square, which is a much more natural kind of shape to look at. And there is a product formula for the number of those tilings, but it's a product over some algebraic numbers, or if you prefer, trigonometric expressions. And it was found by Castellane, it was found by Temperley and Leib in the early 1960s. And it's an important formula, and it's one worth understanding. But it's not a nice number, and here I confess to a bias. I like numbers with small prime factors, things like Catalan numbers and things like that. And this is just not in that zone. It's a very different vibe. So I thought, no, I want something that's nicer than this formula, the Castellane formula. So looking back at hexagons, can I show you a hexagon? Well, if you look at these edges over here of this region, notice the height function goes 4, 3, 2, and then it goes 2, 3, 4. So when you have straight bits in the grid of triangles with six triangles around a vertex, when you go straight, the height function increases. On the other hand, and so if you had a hexagonal region that went like the height function would go 4, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 4. When you have a hexagon, the height functions, has these big rises and falls. That's related to the fact that you don't see the full entropy of the dimer model on a honeycomb graph, the dual of this graph, when you do this kind of game, because you somehow expect the height function to be flat and not have these dramatic rises and falls. If you look at the height function for a domino tiling, notice as you travel along straight things, the height goes up, down, up, down, up, down. So it's really staying kind of constant. So 3, 4, 3, 4, 3, 3, 2, 3, 2. The height fluctuations are smaller. And now we know, although we didn't know this back then, that there's kind of a loss of entropy in the tilings of a region associated with having boundaries that aren't flat but have, large scale height changes along the boundary. So the height is really the key to understanding why some regions that have the same area as other regions have far fewer tilings. It's typically because the height is changing along the boundary, and that imposes constraints that propagate into the interior.
Here by entropy, do you mean sort of asymptotic growth rates of numbers and number of tilings, or
Yes,
what do you?
that's what I
Okay.
mean.
All right.
So with Aztec diamonds, as you travel around a corner, if this were like an Aztec diamond, we would see the height go 3, 2, 1, 0, -1. We'd see a sort of dramatic rise in the height around the boundary. So we'd expect some sort of decrease in the number of tilings. And in fact, we do see that. That's what Grenzing, Carlson, and Zapp saw also, is they weren't seeing the full entropy. I just thought, well, in the hexagon tiling with lozenges, you have six edges where the height goes steadily up, steadily down, steadily up, steadily down, steadily up, steadily down. Whereas in the domino tilings of the 2n by 2n square, we see the height going wiggle, 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 wiggle along all four edges. What if we took a rotated by 45 degrees square where the height was going steadily up along one edge, steadily down along another, steadily up along the third edge, and steadily down along the fourth edge? That would be more analogous to the hexagon, just in terms of colorings. Now, why that should translate into the presence of nice formulas is a big mystery. I don't think anyone really understands it. The operative phrase is domain wall boundary conditions. And I don't know of a physicist who can really describe to me what a domain wall boundary is. I have some thoughts in that direction, but nothing that would lead me to make an actual mathematical definition. But one way you can think about that is there are certain forms of long-range order in these tilings that are extremely rigid. Like in the domino tiling, if you were to set up a kind of a brick wall of horizontal dominoes that all have shaded squares on the left and unshaded squares on the right, you could fill the plane with those. And if you removed any of the tiles and said, well, how can I tile this big hole of area 1,000,000 inside the tiling? Turns out you have no freedom. You have to put those tiles back where you found them. So these are kind of extremal pure states for this model. In a stat-mech term, we use the term Gibbs states. So I believe one way to get interesting enumeration problems is to set up some Gibbs states that are kind of out at infinity and they're kind of clashing, and you remove some of the tiles in the middle where they meet, and then you let them fight it out. That's a sort of intuition I have for how you can generate good tiling problems. And you'll see later on, I'm going to do this again when I invent bezels, but that's a later part of my talk. Now, let me see how I'm doing for time. That was a great question, and I love talking about this stuff, but I don't want to run over time. So, anyway, yeah, Thurston used height functions to provide a linear time algorithm. I want to count things. Here's a formula. Here's a formula. There's how it was anticipated. Anyway. As I said, Doron's work inspired me to say, let's generate random tilings. And I was able to do this using a nice, bijective procedure. This is not a great picture, but you can sort of see part of what's going on. Some of those dominoes are thinner than others. I apologize. They should all be the same size. This was a PostScript picture that wasn't well made at the time. Well, it was well made for its time, but it hasn't survived the past 30 years very well. But you can see that at the top and bottom, we have horizontal dominoes exclusively. And at the left and right, we have vertical dominoes exclusively. And somehow, this is the presence of those changes in height along the boundary propagating into the interior because height functions can't instantaneously jump a lot. There's kind of a Lipschitz condition that the height function has to satisfy because when you travel along a tile edge, the height can only go up or down by one. So Another way to think about what height functions do is they mediate the effective boundary conditions on the interior. Because you might not realize that you can't have, near the top of this thing, you can't just see an arbitrary tiling. But with height functions, you can see what those constraints amount to and how they impose what's going on. Here's a better picture. Here's a random lozenge tiling of a hexagon. And again, you can see that in the corners, there's a lot of constraints that are being imposed by the boundary conditions. So, how did I generate that last picture? One way to generate random tilings, such as lozenge tilings of hexagons, is to start with non-random tilings and randomize them for long enough. Okay. Trying to figure out what long enough really means, David Wilson and I came up with something called coupling from the past, which effectively lets you use a finite amount of computation to achieve randomization for infinite time. But that's another story. But I want to talk about.
Jim, that was the same paper where you had the famous algorithm for spanning tree, random spanning tree, or is it a different paper?
Different paper.
Okay. Is it before or after?
About the same time. I mean, we did the work
Okay.
at the same time. I forget which one we were able to get published
Thank you.
first.
A beautiful work.
Yeah. But so what I mean by randomize is just kind of doing a very naive thing where you repeatedly take a 2x2 square, this is for dominoes, and replace it by a 2x2 square that's tiled the other way. And these are called tatami moves. They long predate my work. And if you perform tatami moves randomly, you can get any tiling to turn into any other. And what's more, the initial tiling converges in distribution to a uniform random tiling. So that's one way to explore these things experimentally, is just take some region, take a non-random initial tiling, and randomize it. Likewise, for lozenge tilings of regions, not just hexagons, here's what's called a cube move. So through repeated applications of a cube move, any lozenge tiling of a simply connected finite plane region can be converted into any other. And if you perform these moves randomly, the initial tiling converges in distribution again to a uniform random tiling. So with various collaborators, Cohn, Elkies, Jakisch, Larson, and Shore, I proved some rigorous results about the macroscopic behavior of random tilings. And it turns out for domino tilings of Aztec diamonds and lozenge tilings of hexagons, as the size of the region grows to infinity, the boundary between the frozen region near the boundary, where the tiles are almost certainly fixed, and the jumbled region in the interior converges in law to a perfect circle. So after I proved these results, I did a little bit of work on tilings, but I basically got interested in other things such as chip firing, quasi-random processes, sand piles fits in with chip firing, dynamical algebraic combinatorics. And that brings us up to the last 5 years, where I didn't have any really pressing projects from dynamical algebraic combinatorics, so I wondered, well, what should I work on now? I thought, why not go back to tilings for a bit and take a fresh look at the work that inspired me in the first place? So here are again those different tiles you're allowed to use, the triangular tiles that they had called T2 tiles and the line tiles that have been called L3 tiles. In the literature on polyominoes and polyhexes and polyiamonds and tiles in general, there's a large recreational math literature which has given various sorts of names to these things. No one had named these tiles. So I decided I would name them. So I called the T2 tile stones and the L3 tiles bones. Now, in the language of statistical physics, these are trimers. And physicists had given various non-rigorously proved asymptotic enumerative results, but no exact enumerations analogous to McMahon's formula for lozenge tilings or the Elkies et al. Formula for domino tilings of Aztec diamonds. So I thought, what regions should I try to tile with stones and bones if the goal is to find exact formulas? So I don't have time to say why I came up with this, but using analogy and what I knew about other tiling models where there were exact formulas, I came up with this kind of a shape, which I called a bezel, and I conjectured some exact formulas for the number of stones and bones tilings of these regions where you allow various subsets of the set of tiles. And this is a two-parameter family of shapes, and there you can see both the tiles and the dual trimer configurations. Working with Colin Defant, Lee Foster, Rupert Lee, and Benjamin Young, I proved several of these, and others were reformulated as dimer problems that were in turn solved by Seok-Hyun Byun, Mihai Chukwu, and Yin Yi Lin Lee. And I learned about their result at my birthday conference, and that was the best, I think, birthday present I got there. And you can see the official web page on Benzels. So every place you see red font, that's a clickable link in the PDF. What about the last 0.5 years or the last 200 or so days? Well, I've been doing a lot of collaboration over Zoom. In that article that I gave links to, conjectured some exact formulas, there was one problem that was not like the others. It was a sort of a structural conjecture. It was actually a repeat of a guess that I or someone else had made in the 1990s regarding moves that should allow us to convert any stones and bones tiling T sub one of a finite simply connected region into any other stones and bones tiling T2 of that region. So here's problem 19 from that collection of 20 problems. Can every tiling of a simply connected region by stones and bones be mutated into every other such tiling by means of a succession of two flips? So these are going to be analogs of the tatami moves and the cube moves. There are two kinds of such moves. There's a type one move, which trains a stone and a bone for a stone and a bone, tiling of a T3 subregion. And then there's type two, which trades in two bones for two stones. By the way, I should say I was partly inspired in my choice of this by work that had been done by Igor Pak and Scott Sheffield, who proved something similar for what are called ribbon tilings, which I don't have time to talk about. So here's the strategy for proving this conjecture. I've actually got a refinement, a strengthening of this conjecture that gives an exact formula for the minimum number of moves required to turn T1 into T2. And it's empirically supported, and it's analogous to similar formulas that have been proved to work by Nicolò Saldana and others for domino tilings and lozenge tilings. So here's the conjecture. There's a typo on this slide, right parenthesis you should ignore. The moves distance between T1 and T2 is equal to a rescaled version of a certain sum. Oh, I should say what P is. So P is varying over all the vertices of the tiling, and theta 1 of P is the height of the vertex P with respect to the tiling T sub 1, and theta of 2 of P is the height of the vertex P relative to the tiling T sub 2. And I'll say in a minute why I'm taking the L1 norm of the difference between those heights. But you add that up, that's a bunch of numbers, and you divide by 36. It's not hard to show that this quantity is a lower bound on the moves distance. So, in particular, if my conjecture is wrong and there are two tilings that are not related by these moves, then the moves distance is infinity. And yes, this quantity is a lower bound on infinity. But in every case I've tried, this lower bound on the moves distance is actually equal to the moves distance, just as analogous functions are for lozenge tilings and domino tilings. So what is theta? These height functions, theta, take their values not in Z, but in the two-dimensional discrete space consisting of triples that add up, triples of integers that add to zero. So I'm going to describe the relevant height functions in a minute, but let me just give you some global pictures of what the space of tilings looks like when you connect two tilings by an edge, when you can do a move that joins them. So here's the space of lozenge tilings of a hexagon. So here the vertices correspond to the 20 ways to tile a regular hexagon of side length 2 with lozenges, and edges correspond to cube moves. And we can see that there are two special tilings, which are the only vertices of degree 1 in this picture, and those are the two extremal tilings. And these are tilings where you can do only a single move, namely a move in the very middle, only a cube move in the middle. What about domino tilings of a square? Okay, so now the vertices correspond to the tilings, edges correspond to tatami moves, and again, there are only two special vertices, and there's a nice symmetry that exchanges them. And here are those two extremal tilings. And once again, you can see the tilings are very rigid. And the only place you can do any moves is in the middle. But you can also sort of see what I was saying before about how at the very top of the picture you see this sort of kind of brick wall pattern. So those are the sort of pure phases of stat mech, and they're sort of fighting things out, and the middle is the place where the real action is, at least at the start. And then the contest can spread to a larger portion of the plane. So here's the space of stones and bones tiling of a triangle. So now the vertices correspond to tilings, and the edges correspond to two flips. And we get two special ver sorry, three special tilings. And what are they? Well, here's what they look like. Okay. And once again, there's only one place where you can do a move. Actually, there's two ways to make that move, because you can take here that stone and either move it down into the left or down into the right. So now I'm going to tell you what these height functions are. Let me just check myself for time. Yep, I can finish in 10 minutes. So height is now a triple of integers that goes up by the ith standard basis vector minus the jth standard basis vector when you travel along a tile edge with color I to your left and color j to your right. So e1 is 100, e2 is 010, e3 is 001. So purple is color number one, orange is color number two. And when you travel from p to q, the height of q is equal to the height of p plus this vector, 1 minus 1, 0, with a 1 in position 1 because you've got the first color to your left, that's purple, with a minus 1 in position number 2 because to the right you see the second color, which is orange, and the third element of that triple is 0 because there is no green cell to your left or to your right. So that's how the height function is defined, except you can't reach every vertex in the underlying grid by traveling along a tile edge because there are these stones. And the central vertex of that stone can't be reached by a tile edge. Well, there's a kludge that works. We assign each vertex in the interior of a stone a height equal to the average of the height of its three neighbors. So in this picture, if you travel around the boundary of the stone, the heights are forced by the sort of rule that I gave before. So, for example, when we go from here to here, there's a purple to your left, so you go up by one. There's an orange to your right, so the middle thing goes down by one, and there's no green in sight, so the green height stays the same. And you follow this rule for the middle, and you give that height. Oh, that's a mistake. It should be 0, 0, 0, 0. That's the average of the three heights. I'll fix that in the PDF. So the last 20 days, we found shortest paths between the extremal tilings that validate our predictions about how far apart they should be. So when I say this kludge works, by the way, what I mean is it basically agrees with this formula, that it makes this formula appear to work. And this gives a prediction for the moves distance between those extremal tilings, these guys, and in fact, that we found the shortest paths that seem to do that, about how far apart they are. In the last 2 days, or about 50 hours, we met over Zoom to make a plan for classifying the 72 different moves you get when you take color into account. So we wanted to know which of the 72 moves move you closer to or further from this or that extremal tiling of the triangle. So it's got more possibilities than the lozenge tiling problem or the domino tiling problem, but we think we now have a sort of a handbook that tells us how to make progress. So here was our intercontinental meeting over Zoom this past Monday. So in the picture, see Colin DeFant, me, Rupert Lee at the upper right. Rupert was in England. Hannah Mlarchik, sorry, Chris Moore, lower left. Hannah Mlarchik, who was meeting with me in Cambridge, and Ben Young at the lower right, who was in Oregon. Here's an example of our process. This is something we put on the whiteboard just on Monday. Our other group member, Lee Foster, couldn't make it to the Zoom meeting, but here's what she looks like. So what about the future? I feel we're very close to understanding what's going on with stones and bones tilings of triangles, and maybe a few weeks away from simply connected regions in general. I'm also hoping we'll find an efficient algorithm, maybe even linear time, for telling when a region can be tiled with stones and bones, because a priori still all we know is that there's an exponential time way to do it. Also, what do random stones and bones tilings look like? Once we know that these moves really tend to mix things up and will converge over long enough times to the uniform distribution, we could just use Markov chain Monte Carlo. Maybe we can come up with something like coupling from the past using height functions. I guess I didn't mention that before, but the whole technology of coupling from the past really hinges on having something like height functions around. So height functions are also useful to facilitate random generation of combinatorial objects. Anyway, we haven't done the experiments yet, but that's coming soon, so stay tuned. So All slides are available on the web with their mistakes, which I'll fix at some point. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to take questions you haven't already asked.
Yeah, Jim, I have a couple of questions. Well, really, really beautiful talk. And thanks for reminding me all this beautiful work and the brand new stuff. Well, really, really fascinating.
Thank you.
It's still a very, very active field. I have a general question. At the very beginning, it was Lagayas and Conway proved the possibility and impossibility of tiling by these specific tiles. Is there a nice formula for those for which it's possible?
I have looked, and I have not found any. Not for tilings of a triangle. Bezels, yes. Triangles, no.
But do they have the first few? Is on the first few terms in the enumerating sequence? Is it in the OIS? Is it
it
somewhere?
Is. It is. In fact, it's been used at least once as a code challenge, where they have these challenges where you're supposed to write code as quickly as possible to solve some problem. So yes, if you look in the OEIS, maybe I should put links to those entries
Yeah, that's neat.
into the talk. Yeah, there are numbers, so you can do numerology on them. I haven't really found any patterns. So you can look at just stones, you can look at just bones. Well, of course, for just bones, there aren't any. But for certain congruence classes, you can look at the stones tilings of triangle, and those are numbers. They've been tabulated. I don't see any patterns there. You can also combine stones and bones, and then you can do it whenever n is congruent to 0 or 2 mod 3. But again, I don't see any patterns for counting them. That
Thank
doesn't mean
you.
there aren't any, just haven't seen any
That
patterns.
was beautiful.
Are there other questions?
I have a question. I don't
Yeah.
know if anyone remote. You had a formula with 1/36 in it, and I'm
Yeah.
just like, where did that 1/36 come from? Is there an easy way to understand that? Maybe it was 1/60. I'm not sure.
With 1/36. Yeah, I mean, the only answer is a sort of a nitty-gritty answer, and there's a bit of luck that I don't understand. So there's these two kinds of moves. There we are. Two kinds of moves. And so the height is going to change, it turns out, for type one moves at four different places. So the height changes in the middle of this bone, sorry, the middle of this stone, and the height changes at these three vertices, which are also in the interior. So there are four interior vertices altogether where the height changes, the heights change. And so this is very different from domino and lozenge tilings, where there's only one vertex whose height changes. It's in the case of the domino tilings, when you do a tatami move, the height at the center of the 2x2 square changes, but all the heights along the boundary stay the same. When you do a cube move on a lozenge tiling, again, there's only one vertex in the middle of the hexagon whose height changes, and all the other tiles, all the vertices going around the hexagon stay the same height. So this shouldn't work. I mean, this technology shouldn't be useful for anything because the height is changing at too many places at once, not just one place, but four places. And what's more, here the geometry of the four places where they're changing is kind of like a claw graph, a vertex with three, edges coming out of it. Here also, for type two moves, there are four internal vertices whose heights change. In the right, there are two vertices that are internal to these stones, and then there are two vertices where the height changes that are along the boundaries of the shared boundary of those two stones. But again, the heights change there. So there was a point where I was saying, the natural way to measure distance between tilings is to take the distance in this triangular grid between the height here and the height here, and then take the distance between the heights of this vertex and the corresponding vertex here, and do this for all four vertices whose heights have changed in this discrete two-dimensional space, with these, coordinatized by I, j, and k being integers summing to zero, and just take the L1 distances between them and add them up. And you get 36. Okay? Do the same thing with the type two moves. I don't see why you should also get the same number. But you do. You also get 36. So if that hadn't worked out, it would be a situation where type one moves give you a certain kind of height change, and type two moves give you another kind of height change. And maybe there would still be an analog of, where's the formula? Of this formula. There might have to be like a formula that would sort of discriminate between the two different kinds of moves. Like the number of moves you do of each type would give different height changes, but then how do you know how many moves of each type you have to do? You know, it's not clear that this kind of formula would exist in any usable way. But basically, because of this happy accident that the two kinds of moves affect this kind of kludgy definition of height that requires, you know, taking a leap into thinking about taking the average of the heights in the interior, just so happens to give you, first of all, consistency. I guess I didn't comment on that. But because all of these tiles that you're looking at, stones and bones, consist of three, sorry, consist of two purple, two orange, and two green tiles, for the same sort of reason as before, when you go around the boundary of any tile, it has to add, the changes add up to 0, 0, 0, 0. I didn't comment on that. But that's kind of why I used the definition of heights that I did, is to make things add up to 0 going around the boundary of a tile, given that each tile consists of one orange, one purple, and one green hexagon. But it still was very lucky that these two different kinds of moves both, you know, seem to change the height by 36. And so that's how, you know, I got it. But that's kind of where the 36 comes from, and that's kind of where the 72 comes from. There are just lots of different things to look at. And part of it is also that with these moves, where are the moves here? Yeah, you really have to pay attention to color. So I haven't colored these things in, but just as for domino tilings, there's a difference between shaded on the left and unshaded on the right, and vice versa. And the height function really depends on that, and you know, the whole theory really depends on that. There's an underlying three coloring here. So each one of these moves is actually three different moves, but you can do the moves in two different directions, going from left to right or right to left. But there's also rotations that you can do in the plane that sort of turn, like the type one move exists in an upside down version, and the type two move exists in six different orientations. So that's kind of where the 72 comes from, is all those different combinations, you know, of orientation and coloring you have to take into account for these type one and type two moves. So that's where the 36 and the 72 come from. It's just all more complicated, but we think we'll still be able to manage it.
Thank you.
So I have a related question. Is there a way to naturally orient when you do the flip? So that you're
Not sure what you mean.
so that like in your graph of the space of tilings, like is there a way to naturally oriented, so it becomes an oriented graph.
There are three different ways to do it, or possibly six, depending upon what you want. But yes, we're actively exploring that now. So I didn't really talk about this very much, but this graph is actually the Hasse diagram of a lattice. And so is this graph. And that's part of what height functions buy you, is they put a lattice structure on this set of combinatorial objects. Not just a poset, but a lattice. Not just a lattice, but a distributive lattice. So something like that is going on here. But just as a lattice really is a lattice and its opposite, kind of, here we have six different lattices, or maybe they're not lattices, but six different partial orderings that fit together according to the three colorings. So there's some, you can make something more purple and less orange, and that's one direction to go. You can make something more orange but less purple. That's the opposite, but you can also look at purple and green or orange and green. So yes, we're actively trying to think about how partially ordered sets and maybe lattice theory might give us a kind of roadmap for moving through this diagram and telling us how to make progress towards a goal. But now there's more ways to choose a goal and more ways to get there. Oh, and let me answer a question that no one has asked. Why am I going with purple, orange, and green instead of blue, green, and red, which is the more natural choice of three colors and the one that I originally chose? It's because there are many forms of color blindness that make it hard for people to see pictures that have blue, green, and red and to tell the colors apart. So Lee Foster is an expert on color theory and also on various kinds of, you know, chromatic differences between people. And so we hit on purple, orange, and green as something that works for more people in terms of accessibility.
Can I ask another question? So on slide 45.
Let me move to slide 45. Whoops. Yeah.
Or maybe it's just a comment. So this reminds me of the type A reflection per group because of the EI minus EJ.
Yeah. Yeah, there
Is
may be
there?
a reflection group story here, although I don't know how it would translate into higher, values of n for an.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Colin has been musing about that. I think also ribbon tilings might fit into this picture too, but that's still speculative.
Are there questions?
I guess I have a comment slash question, which is, it seems like just very recently, just in the last couple of years, there's other life in the world of tilings, and I don't know it very well, so I don't see that there's any connection between what you're talking about here and this other stuff. So I'm thinking about the Einstein tile work, and also a resolution of the periodic tiling conjecture by Tao and friends. So this has to do with whether if a tile tiles, then aperiodically, then must it also tile periodically a space? So I'm wondering whether or not this is in the air for you in regards to bringing back tilings, or whether this is all just sort of different things happening in different areas without much overlap.
I don't think the work on Einstein's inspired me because it's too recent, and the same for the Tao et al. Work on, periodic versus aperiodic behavior of tilings. But I will say that even going back to Penrose tilings, there is this part of tiling theory which is concerned with using higher dimensional spaces to understand two-dimensional tilings. Like the Penrose tile really lives, I think, in a five-dimensional space. And the way you do that, or one way to do that, is exactly this kind of game of locally figuring out how the behavior of a tiling in two dimensions can be lifted locally into a higher dimensional space. Then, when you follow things around a path in the tiling, you get this kind of consistency. So, the idea that a higher dimensional perspective gives you more power over what's going on and more understanding, is definitely a linking theme between the work on the Einstein and the hat tiling and the specter tiling and stuff like that on the one hand, and my work. But here's a big difference. Those tilings tend to be really, really rigid. In fact, if you do a height function on a Penrose tile, not only does the height not really change much along boundaries, that's kind of how they're defined. They're defined in such a way that you basically are confining the height fluctuations on the boundary so much that it specifies a unique tiling. It's a very different philosophy from stat mech, where things have a lot of freedom. And what I'm doing, where I'm putting boundary conditions that constrain that freedom in ways that stat mech people, in earlier decades found unphysical and therefore uninteresting, is that I don't constrain it so much that I get something like an aperiodic order on the tilings, because that would have entropy zero, and it might be interesting from an enumerative perspective, but I really like to find enumerative formulas that describe bigger numbers but make them tractable, numbers that grow exponentially in the area of the region being tiled. And that seems to involve having something along the boundary where the behavior, is not wiggle, 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 but steady motion in some direction and then steady motion in some other direction along the boundary. And Bensels fit that bill. Triangles do not. I mean, I'm using triangles because they seem to be the easiest thing to study when we're tiling with stones and bones. But I wouldn't have expected nice enumerative formulas for triangles, just because it's more analogous to domino tilings of 2n by 2n squares, where there is an exact formula, but it's not as nice as what we get for Aztec diamonds, for instance.
Are there more questions? Maybe from people in the audience.
I haven't
I
been
don't see
following the
anything.
chat. Maybe there's questions in the chat. I don't see the chat though.
Yes, so not currently.
Okay.
I guess if, I do have one more question. I don't know. I feel like I'm being a bit greedy here, but I'm wondering whether or not you've shown these spaces of tilings by Stones and Bones, and that makes me wonder whether there's any sort of group or semi-group that's acting on these spaces. So that's kind of what I'm looking for from the dynamical edge. Like I'm looking for some sort of group action or semi-group action, which allows me to sort of understand dynamics on these spaces. But I understand the Markov chain method sort of naturally suggests itself here for like mixing and stuff like that. But what is there any group or semi-group behind the scenes acting on these objects?
There absolutely is. That's Conway and Ligarius's whole thing, is they come up
Okay.
with. Here's maybe the technically correct description. So they come up with this non-commutative group associated with tilings with stones and bones. And what I'm presenting here with these heights is sort of a quotient group, a commutative quotient of their group. So it doesn't carry the full structure that they found, but we don't really need it for my purpose. But one thing that this height function approach doesn't really capture, as far as I know, is this result that Conway and Ligarius showed, which is that if you've got a region, simply connected region, that can be tiled by stones and bones, the number of upward pointing stones minus the number of downward pointing stones is independent of the tiling. So you could derive that as a consequence of my claim that you can get from any tiling to any other by means of these type one and type two moves, because the type one move leaves the number of upward pointing stones alone or the number of downward pointing stones alone, but the type two move either annihilates a stone with the opposite direction stone or creates them out of nowhere, but it leaves that difference invariant. So I don't think you can use my kind of height function to prove Conway and Ligarius's result. So there are definitely some things missing from this. So it's possible that if instead of using this kind of an abelian height function, you used a height function taking values in Conway and Ligarius's group, that you'd get even more understanding of what's going on. But then you wouldn't have, what we've got is hard enough. It's basically a function from the plane, from the triangular grid in the plane to the triangular grid in the plane, the height spaces. A two-dimensional triangular grid. So it's kind of a graph that lives in four dimensions, unlike Thurston's graphs, pictures that live in three dimensions. But if the fibers in the picture are no longer in an abelian group, but in this non-commutative group, then I have no intuition for how to think about that. But again, might be really interesting.
So thank you very much, Jim.
Thank
So
you,
that's
Wendy.
thank you.
Gotta get the Zoom
Wait,
reaction.
that doesn't work.
Oh no.
Wow.
Oh, great. It's so tiny.
I see. All
Is it
right.
still recording? Because
Let me.
I hit
Yeah, let
stop,
me.
pause, record. Oh, there it is. I'm going to stop it now.